Ready? Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order and open up the first public hearing on HB 2361 and 2435, both. And I've asked Representative Roblin to present on both those bills, since this is Arnie Roblin Day in the House Healthcare Committee. And then he's going to go off and chair his own committee that he's going to be late to be at.
Yes.
Representative Roblin, please.
Thank you, Chair Greenleck. For the record, Arnie Roblin, representative from House District 9, and also the committee members. The first bill I'll talk about is House Bill 2435, and you should be getting some materials about both of these bills.
Representative Bentz?
Yes, he's coming afterwards.
Why don't you come up also?
He's going to come afterwards. He has some guests with him.
Okay.
So.
Oh, okay, great. I'm sorry.
That's
go
okay.
Ahead, please.
So thank you. Let me start with the other bill first, actually, just because it's the shorter one, and I think I may be the only person testifying. And 2361 is regarding requires health benefit plan to cover drugs containing pseudoephedrine for allergy symptoms in plans that plan coverage those prescription drugs for allergy symptoms. Adds orthotic and prosthetic devices to cross-reference for coverage of health care service contractors and multiple employer welfare arrangements. That last part was a correction, and my relating clause seemed to work for the people who were waiting for this, so they put the prosthetic, so I don't know a lot about that one. But and you can read the testimony I'm putting. I just want to give a face to what this bill is about. I had a constituent who had been taking the pseudoephedrine product, and when we changed the law and put it behind the counter, it still worked, but when it became a prescription-only drug, which I think has done wonders in our meth situation, he went in to get his prescription and found that the cost for his prescription had gone from about $20 to $40 at this particular rural pharmacy, and when they submitted it, it came back denied for coverage, because it doesn't have the federal caution that prohibits the dispensing without a prescription label. That created a problem for him, because this is the drug that seemed to work. And so out of that came this bill that basically says that when we make decisions like that, we need to talk to the people in our state, the insurance coverage people, and if they're going to cover a particular other medication that is prescribed, they should cover this particular one and other drugs if we do the same thing. My feeling here is that we have a lot of companies actually already did that, and I think you may hear from some of those companies if they choose to be here. When I checked around, there were a number of companies that automatically did it. It was a prescription. They paid it. There was no problem. This particular case, he came back with a letter from the insurance company saying, sorry, we don't cover this particular drug. He has not found a different drug that works as well for him, and I think they've tried other things. This is the one that works for him, and they believe that it should be covered by his insurance coverage.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it, and unless anyone has questions on that one, you can read the other information that we put together on that.
Are there any questions?
It's a pretty simple and straightforward.
I do have a couple. What's that ORS 743A.001?
Okay, now I have to go back and look.
This section is exempt from. We were about... Do you have any idea what that
is? I don't.
Okay, that's line 15.
15, and I can check on that, but it came from...
We'll take a look at it here.
43.
Yep.
And what's the orthotics business in here?
Yeah, I was telling people that was an additional part that was left out of a bill that we passed a few years ago, that when they found the relating clause worked, they stuck it in very quickly. So it was a surprise to me as well.
What is it?
It has to do with...
Oh,
you know, yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
I know.
But I did call and question legislative counsel. It's clearly housekeeping. These were, when we passed the orthotic bill last session, these statutes were missed, and this is a housekeeping bill to bring everything copacetic.
It's page 4, line 31. Is that the whole reference?
Yes.
That's exactly the answer that I got, so thank you. I didn't understand the answer, but that was the answer that I got.
And the 743A001 ORS is an automatic repeal of certain statutes on individual and group health insurance
okay,
statutes.
Same thing.
It doesn't sunset then.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. Questions? Is there any opposition? I'm sorry.
No, this is squeezing the balloon. You solve one problem and create another one.
I mean the other one. Yeah, that's right.
Pops out somewhere.
That's right. Prescription benefits usually are only for prescription-only drugs. Turns out we've created the prescription-only drug, but it doesn't fit the usual definition.
Yes, sir. Maybe, and I apologize for getting here late, Representative Rivlin, but what happened to the cost of this drug when it went from over-the-counter to... Or over the counter, but behind the counter.
These are fairly rural places. This is a very small town that actually happened in Reedsport. His belief was the cost doubled.
The price doubled. Not the price doubled.
The price doubled.
Right. I meant the price. Yeah.
Well, a prescription fee was added.
I'm sure that's yeah.
Because it's a prescription, it wasn't a prescription before.
Was your question about when it went behind? The counter, or when it became prescription? Did the price go up?
Yeah. My understanding is when it went to prescription is when the price went up.
Why don't we take that off?
I take what off? Well, you missed the whole debate on methamphetamine. In the last section. But the short answer is that we had a big problem with meth labs, and it related to all sorts of stuff. It didn't relate too much to the supply of meth in the environment because we have it from Mexico and everywhere else. But it apparently stopped the cooking almost completely by taking this away. And that meant a lot of less trouble with foster kids who were taken out of homes and a variety of things. So I think everybody's pretty happy with having it on prescription, or most people have become accommodated to it. But this is just an anomaly people that don't have prescription insurance are faced, I'm sure, not with a doubling.
My comment would be, if it wasn't the case, if the price had not gone up, there probably would not have been a need for this bill. At least I would assume that what motivates this is a desire to be able to afford the medication that the patient is accustomed to purchasing over the counter at a relatively low price.
I would say that, I can't speak for the individual other than to say that I think if it was a prescription, he would still have been upset if his drug coverage didn't cover it.
Interesting.
Even if it hadn't gone up. But he did note in his letter to us, and hopefully we'll get you a copy of that as well, his actual letter to me. We asked him, and he said that would be fine to share.
Representative Thompson, Representative Harker, and then you, sir.
Yeah, just to add some perspective to this, one of the problems, or I guess not really a problem, situations we created here in Oregon, I believe we're still the only state that took these drugs to prescription. And what we really did was created a new class of drugs because they're over-the-counter in the rest of the country, but they require identification to get them and signing of a signature log and a lot of paperwork. So Oregon has the simplest system. By just making it prescription, it controls the delivery, and it saves a lot of time at the pharmacy end because you don't have to maintain the logs and turn them over to law enforcement and all of these other procedural things. But it is a problem because it did go up remarkably. All of the pseudoephedrine products went up considerably when they went behind the counter. Ostensibly, that's because of extra handling on the part of the pharmacy staff, because they have to treat them as if they're prescription drugs in terms of inventorying and dispensing. But they, in fact, in the rest of the world, are not. Mm. So it's an access problem.
Representative Harker?
I just threw it out there in the conversation already.
Sir?
I think there's something else in the cost of this that we're missing, and that is, in order to get a prescription, you have to see a provider with prescribing authority.
Yes.
So there is a cost associated with actually seeing the provider, and sometimes that gets left out.
Yeah.
Yep, that all got into the debate, didn't it? I mean, it was a serious debate.
Cost and inconvenience, if I may add.
It was a very good debate with regard to the meth issue, and we had gone to keeping the lists and behind the counter. It had not caused a drop in the number of labs that they were breaking into, the police were finding and confiscating. This has dramatically changed that. So it has changed a different health issue that has been significantly changed in rural areas where I come from, and I think other people. We aren't finding those labs. They don't seem to exist. That doesn't mean that meth is not still here. It's still here. It's a different deal. But it has solved the problem in a fairly dramatic way, if I were in talking to the police and others. So it is this cost balance of how we regulate things in society.
We saw some interesting data, I think, in the Human Services Committee where the foster placement went up dramatically and then is leveled off. It's not placement of the cash flow. Before you move to the next bill, we have some public testimony, some written testimony to acknowledge. Is that right,
Madam? Mr. Chair, that testimony is on HB 2435 for the record. Do you want to announce that written testimony on the next bill?
Where are we?
We're on 2361.
Okay, I know. I'm sorry. Then we'll wait to the next bill. Are there any other questions? And nobody else to testify?
I'm sorry. There's going to, if you require it to be covered, there's going to be a cost to the insurance company, which translates to an increased cost to people that buy policies. And
well, let's debate it when we get to a
okay,
session.
Thank you.
Yeah. And we'll decide then, but we might as well close the public hearing, and then we'll close the work session on 2360. I mean, the public hearing on 2361. We're in the other one now. So.
Okay. Again, Arne Roblin, State Representative from District 9. Thank you, Chair Greenlich and the committee, for hearing this bill. This bill is an offshoot of some meetings that the Rural Health Policy Committee of the interim took to Southern Oregon, and a continuation of some tours that we took around rural Oregon during the interim. When we took that tour, we asked, what are the issues that are creating the largest problems in some of these rural communities and their the providing of care for rural Oregonians? And one of the issues that kept coming up over and over again and was highlighted at our stop in Reedsport, Oregon, where they had a number of doctors retire in a short period of time and others leave. So they lost 50% of their doctors in the community. And then they started the process of trying to get doctors. And time again, doctors who were planning on coming and thinking of coming found that getting all of the documentation in and getting a certificate so that they could actually practice in Oregon was very difficult. And we heard from situations of up to a year for people from out of the country trying to come in who eventually left, made the choice to go to Canada as opposed to the United States, and kept in contact, which was interesting. They had made relationships with people as they were trying to move. And others who in the process made choices to go to other states as opposed to come to Oregon because of the difficulty in getting through the process of getting their license. I looked and checked and talked to a number of other hospitals after, because that was towards the end of the tour, and the committee people we talked to, other hospitals that we'd gone and said, was this a problem with you that we didn't get at the others? And most of them concurred that the length of time it took to get a certificate was extremely long, and that we are in constant competition with other states. Our state does not produce enough doctors, primary care people, to meet the need in our state alone. So we are going to be a state that has to search out and find other people to come to our state. I will say that every one of the doctors that I talked to and each hospital indicated that we like the standards. We have very good standards. We do understand that we want to make sure that people who come here and practice are good, qualified physicians, but that time delays and little issues when one employer won't send something in for a long time and they can't get it and they don't know exactly what isn't happening, I have heard from the board that they have changed some things and put it online so you can know, but still the process seemed to take a long time. And so what this bill simply does is say if a person's coming to this state and they are practicing in another state and the practice, they don't have any blemish on that record, that they can get a license to start practicing. And that process continues to go on. We don't change that process. And at some point, they are either going, 60 days is what it says, they are either going to get a license, a renewal of that license, or they're going to finally get all the stuff there, and a license will be issued to them. I thought originally that the issue was the fact that the medical board meets so rarely, but that is not, I don't think, entirely the issue. And for me, this was an attempt to start having a conversation with you to solve a problem which I think permeates our state with respect to getting physicians licensed in our state and practicing and providing the care that they need in rural, and it may be in other areas. This came up because I was talking to rural doctors, and we have had a very difficult time maintaining the number of doctors necessary for our communities. And so I gave you a write-up of all of the stuff that we did on that tour and a little bit of the history, but in general, that's really what this is about. It's giving us a tool to get doctors licensed quickly, working in these communities, and then to finish up the whole licensure procedure. And I'll leave it at that.
Other questions?
Yes, Chair. Ernie, did you talk to physicians about this? I guess my concern is that if you get a temporary license, you're subject not necessarily to being able to complete the process. And moving to a new state and living on a temporary license probably isn't much an inducement, is my fear.
I did. And actually, again, this morning I had a telephone conversation to the hospital administrator in Reedsport and one of the doctors that's been working there for a number of years. Both were excited that you were having a hearing today on this bill. They believe it can work. The issue is they oftentimes bring these doctors in, and the doctor and the family decide, this is a really unique place. It's the kind of place I want. And some of the time, it's doctors that have been working for a long time, and they've decided that Oregon is the place they want to go. And in my particular case, the Oregon coast is a place that is attractive to them to have their career. And so they've kind of made that decision already, and they are kind of committed to it. But all of a sudden, the process keeps taking longer and longer and longer, and they decide we can't. You need to go someplace else.
We talked to the board, and they agree there's a problem. A lot of times, it's just getting responses.
And I understand that. So if there is another avenue to solve this problem, I am right there working with it in any way that we can. Because for me, the issue is solving the problem. I don't have ownership on what the best way to solve the problem is, but I certainly believe we have to have the conversation and solve the problem.
Representative Bruin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. You alluded, even just now, but earlier in your comments, you alluded to the fact that it's not just a rural Oregon problem, or at least your assumption was it's not just a rural Oregon problem. It, in fact, is a statewide problem. I had a conversation within the last, 6 weeks, with administrators at Legacy Meridian Park Hospital in my district, hearing their laments about the fact that it's so difficult, and I think I've heard the same thing from OHSU folks, but hearing their lament that it's so difficult to attract doctors who may otherwise want to come to Oregon, any part of Oregon, whether it's Portland Metro or in the rural areas, because they start doing the math and the average is 4 months without licensure, and doctors may make a good income, but nobody wants to be in a position where they're not making any income for 4 months due to a licensure issue. So, I mean, I guess I'm asking you, and I think I've already sensed from your comments where you are with this, but you're not, you wouldn't necessarily be defensive about this as only, because I'm with you on this, but I think the problem is bigger than just rural. I think it's statewide. Rural healthcare obviously has issues that more difficult issues sometimes than the urban areas that need to be addressed, but this is definitely a statewide problem. So I'm sort of asking you if you'd had any apprehension or reservations about.
Nope.
Okay.
Is 442.550 restricted to rural?
Yes.
It talks about a qualifying practice site. Maybe a question.
But I am open to that kind of. session. I do want to give it any advantage I can to my rural areas, but I will.
Well, and Mr. Chair, there, I mean, yes, the answer, I mean, regardless of what we do, we have a...
But at the same time, if I can solve the problem for the rest of the state at the same time, I would be totally happy.
And I think helping the entire state would help the rural areas as well.
I just think we have some unique problems with respect to health care right now.
Yeah.
Representative Roblin, his statement about 4 months makes me wonder whether 60 days is the...
Well, yeah. I mean, my hope is that we may have to have the opportunity to renew it as long as the process is going forward.
That may require some amendment.
Yeah.
Representative Thompson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this is a statewide problem. Another incidence where it comes to play is hospitals that try to bring in specialists, like a cancer specialist, and they can bring them in, but they end up in their contractual arrangements having to pay them for 4 months at a pretty good rate while that person can't practice, and they're simply sitting around waiting for licensure. And this would also, I mean, that's got to be a cost driver somewhere to healthcare. And if you know, bring these specialists in, and if they're recognized specialists with good credentials and clean records, you know, give them a provisional license, get them working, and
actually may help recruitment if you can get here and have a 4 month paid vacation.
Hospital administrators go
fishing place. The fishing hole's right there, guys.
Mr. Chair, are we going to hear from the board on this?
We are right next. They're going to be the very next people we're going to hear. I was also wondering if we're going to hear from the OMA, because I know the OMA's had an interest and they've been in my office. Is there?
Mr. Chair,
yep.
I'm questioning, what does 442.550 say? I'm asking that because I'm not finding it.
You don't find the you think it's a mythical number that only appears every 14 years?
No, you just...
It's
you,
in
I'm
Area
sorry.
59.
Scratch that. Scratch that. You have to have a Rhodes Scholar tell you.
It's reappeared.
It's this little barrier. Right?
Okay, we got it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a rural health.
Yeah, it's rural health.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and if there's anything else I can do as this moves on, let me know. Thank you.
We know where to find you.
And I'm heading downstairs.
Go for it. Ms. Haley, we're very anxious to hear from you. Could you join us for us?
Oh, he's deferred to.
Oh,
see, we're all looking out for protocol.
That's right. That's good. Tell us why this is a great idea.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Medical Board.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The board does share the desire of the legislature and the governor to increase quality access to care in Oregon. And we have been actively working with our stakeholders the last couple of years to try to achieve that. We've been working with the Healthcare Workforce Institute to gather data to see where the need is and what particular specialties and where. And we have an ongoing relationship with the Office of Rural Health. In fact, today our staff was working on a webinar with the Office of Rural Health in order to help educate the credentialing staff of particularly small hospitals. Now, I have attached as part of your packet a copy of the board's application for licensure. And with your indulgence, I'd like to walk you through that application and talk with you a little bit about the requirements and the process. The first page is fairly straightforward in terms of identifying information as well as...
Can I ask you a question first as well?
Certainly.
I'm asking other boards? This appears that the board is in opposition to this?
That's correct, Chair.
Has there been a formal board action on this?
There was a voice vote by endorsement of the decision to oppose it.
I'm sorry, what is that?
Well, they didn't take a individual named vote, but they took the all in favor and they said yes.
At a meeting?
Yes.
Okay, that's
yes. Fine. Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, as you can see on the bottom of page one of the application, we're looking for medical education there. On page two, it is the United States Medical Licensing Examination. And the first steps are passed in medical school, and the third is within that first year of postgraduate training. Before the USMLE came into existence, these other exams listed there, the National Board of Medical Examiners, was the examination that was required. We still use the same ones for osteopathic physicians and podiatric physicians that are listed there. In the past, all foreign medical graduates, now known as international medical graduates, used to take that FLEX exam. And I'm still on page 2. The next exam is one for that's used for Canadian graduates. Now, on the bottom of the page is an examination that foreign or international graduates take, which tests basic science as well as English. On page 3, we're looking for where the licensee or applicant has had other licenses and what other states. The next line is whether they want a limited or unlimited license, and then we're looking for hospital staff privileges. If you turn to page 4, we have a chronology of all their activities. And beginning on page 5, we get into what we call the personal history questions. They're on page 6 as well, and then that ends on page 5 and 6. And if you turn to page 7, those are some identifying features: date of birth, place of birth, the photograph, and then where they wish to come and practice. We are currently using that question 27 on page 7 as to where they want to practice to be able to move applicants who want to go to rural Oregon to the top of the pile. At the bottom of that page, we have the specialty board information. And if an applicant does have that specialty board certification, then we can waive some other potential requirements. And then we look for an affidavit on page 8. And, of course, the last page is our credit card payment.
Of course.
In addition to the application, I have also included in your packet a copy of what items are to be submitted by the applicant and what items need to be sent directly from the source. And this page is made available to all applicants. And then I also provided for you a copy of a comparison with our neighboring states in terms of licensing requirements. And this is a up-to-date comparison with California, Idaho, Nevada, and Washington. And as you can see from that chart, the requirements are substantially similar. One of the things I would note is about halfway down in that chart, the employment verifications are one of the things that can hold up an application, because we do like to have validation and verification from each of the employers that there were no problems. And we were asking for 10 years back, prior to our checking with our sister states to find out where they were, and so we went to the 5 years, and now a couple of them, in the time that we had first done this survey, Nevada and Washington now ask for all employment verification. So they're actually asking for a little bit more than we are in that regard. In terms of time, and I've heard some timing thrown out here, the median for the board to license is 75 days. In the fall of 2008, we checked with some of the other states, and in fact, I talked to Idaho today. And for them, it is, for Idaho, it's 2 months, and for Washington right now, it's 3 to 6 months, or it was in the fall of 2008.
That means half of them are longer than 75 days?
That's correct. It's
median.
Mr. Chair, yes.
Do you have a range on that?
I can check and get that for you, okay? We have been listening. The board has been hearing what folks have been saying about the time it takes to get licensed, and we've taken a number of steps to reduce that processing time. First of all, we do move rural applicants to the top of the pile, recognizing that there is a more serious need there. The board used to process through a committee and then onto the full board applicants who would need to be able to take a special purpose examination. They have since waived that processing requirement and delegated that to me. and we looked at 7-month period in 2008, and I was able to approve 52 waivers of that examination. So that shortened the time for those applicants. And this is based on the need to determine whether or not the applicant shows current medical competency. One of the board's other concerns about this bill is additional paperwork for the applicant, because they would have to then apply for the limited license and then go on to fill out a license application for an unlimited license.
Kathleen, why is that? I mean, why can't it just automatically be based on that, where their practice site is?
Mr. Chair, as I read the bill, it says that they're looking for an unlimited license, that the board would issue an unlimited license.
Yeah.
Or, no, excuse me, a limited license. And I would think that long-term the physician would want an unlimited license.
No, my question was not that. My question was, if they've applied for an unlimited license, why can't it just be automatically the application for a limited license as well?
Chair Greenlich, I think we would need to amend the bill to say that the limited would be transferred somehow to an unlimited license.
I have a simpler question.
Okay.
They fill out this form.
Yes.
And if the site on page 4, or wherever that page is, the proposed practice site?
Page 7, item 27.
Yeah. If that is meets the qualifications of 442550, why couldn't this serve automatically as an application for a limited license while you're processing the unlimited license application? Why would they need to file another form that has all the same information?
Chair Greenlich, if we use this application form, we could use it for both. We could use it to stand in for the unlimited license application as well.
Yeah, so I mean, that's what I was assuming you do. You assume you don't want to give somebody a limited, or usually, well, I suppose. Somebody might only want a limited license, huh, for some circumstances.
Chair Greenlich, that's true. And in the past, we used to have a limited license special to try to hold them over to the next board meeting, which is what Representative Roblin was talking about. But we eliminated that because we felt it was too much paperwork and as a way to streamline and get the applicant out in the community as quickly as possible.
But for anybody looking for a limited, an unlimited license that meets a rural requirement under this bill, this could also automatically trigger the request for the limited license.
Chair Greenlich, I think we would need to put that in the bill.
Okay, I can do that. I'm sorry, go ahead. Keep going. You're almost done.
I also provided for you a copy of a chart that demonstrates what the licensing process is. And I think what's significant here are a couple of points. One is that we do have the form online that can be downloaded and filled out and sent to the board. And then once the application is received, the applicant receives an online status number so that they can log in, check the website, and find out what's needed to complete the application process. It shows both what has been received as well as what needs to be received in order to complete that process. We also have a call center and an 800 number to offer further assistance to the applicants. And it's not just the applicants, it's also future employers. It may be a placement company or their family members. Once that application is received, we are constantly processing the additional documents that are required for the application. And then another significant change that the board made in recent times was to delegate to me the authority to issue a license on a weekly basis. So every week I am signing off 4 licenses, and this was a fairly significant change for the board so that the individual would not have to have that limited license or wait for the quarterly meeting to be able to be issued the full license. On the second page of the process, I also have outlined what would happen if an applicant comes to us with some information that requires additional follow-up. And some of that could be, and these are typical types of cases, they may have had a drug or alcohol history, they may have had criminal history, they may have had difficulties in their employment. This is all the type of information that we are gathering throughout this application process, which is one of the board's concerns about this bill, because if an applicant is under investigation, let's say in California, comes across the border gets this limited license, they could be under investigation in their hospital. They could have been terminated by their hospital. They could be under investigation by the California board. And if they were not honest in their application process, we would not know about it, and yet we would be giving them a license and allowing them to practice in Oregon. And really, this is the most significant concern the board has about this bill, is that it would not enable the board to continue its mission of public protection given that potential loophole. I thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Matt, please.
What is the, if an applicant lies on the application form and you go through your investigation process, obviously the application is rejected, but is there any criminal, is there any teeth into it other than a rejection of the application?
Chair Greenlich, Representative Bruin, the board can take different stance. For example, someone may have forgotten some information, so that determination of credibility does need to be made. At the same time, it's hard to believe that someone forgets three criminal convictions, for example.
Easy to forget.
Right. In that kind of a case, the board would have to go through a denial of license process, and then there is a significant legal due process that the board needs to go through as well as the applicant. There are now criminal connections with this at this time.
There are no, did you say?
Correct.
Are applicants aware of the potential penalties for, I mean, I assume on the website or in the instructions to the application, there's probably pretty clear indication of if you knowingly, if you lie on the form, you know, shame on you, plus we'll do A, B, and C. And what I'm trying to get at, Mr. Chair, is, you know, is there a way to either more clearly bring that out for the applicant, or a statute that defines that, or if there is no statute that defines that, maybe adding statute to this bill to make it pretty clear that, yeah, we know that it's going to take us a while to investigate what you say, but if you get it wrong on purpose, know that we're going to come after you with both barrels.
There is on page 5, on the top of page 5, where they start filling out these forms, a note about fraud on this.
Well, maybe Mr. Chair, making the distinction that there'll be no flexibility in our mindset to pursue a fraud charge, yeah. So it's automatic.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, do we assume that other states' licensing agencies are incompetent, and it's if I travel to California or Idaho or Nevada or Washington that I shouldn't seek medical care there because we don't know? I mean, they're not approved by Oregon, so.
I'd be careful about the blood supply.
What, maybe California? Yeah. Or Washington?
Washington.
Okay. I know that's a rhetorical. I'm not going to ask you to answer that. The problem just doesn't seem to be getting fixed. And the issue continues to come up, and we've got to figure out a way to get around this problem. And I think at some point the legislature has to say, we got to make a change. And so even if the language isn't perfect, then you need to tell us how we can improve it so that we can get over this hurdle, so we're not addressing the same thing, not over every 2 years, haven't been around that long, but it's perennially there.
Chair Greenlich, Vice Chair Maurer, I wanted to point out a couple of other things. We have a technology project that's going to be going live this summer. We will be one of the few states that has online licensure, so it won't be a downloaded form. It'll be an electronically submitted form to the board. The other thing that's happening is that the board has taken a number of steps as things have been gone electronic in other venues that we rely on. For example, we want verification from California if you have a license there. There's now a company that will transmit that to us electronically. That's a fairly significant change and has speeded up the process. But not all aspects of this, what has been a largely paper process, have been made electronic to date, and I think that's changing across the country. And I think if you look at the comparison with the other states, it's not as quickly as we'd like it, but we're moving in that direction. The other thing I'd like to point out to you is that we were one of the first states to join with a portability project. That's a national project to look at whether or not we can endorse some of these core documents that we're requiring, such as proof of medical education, if someone has been licensed in another state. This summer, Idaho will be the first state that does this by endorsement. We would like to see how Idaho does with that, and if they are able to cut some of their processing time, we would like to follow suit, which is why we joined the project in the first place. With the licensure by endorsement, which Idaho is going to do, with those core documents, it can be a shorter application, and we can rely on what our sister state has already done, which speaks to your earlier comment.
Oh, just real quick, not to beat a dead horse, but of the applications that you get on an average basis, how many are rejected for being fraudulent?
Chair,
trying to get a magnitude of a potential problem if we went to a short-term licensure.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Bruin, about 3% of the applications that we get have to go through that more complicated process that's on page 2 of your diagram there.
Right. But that's not necessarily fraud. That's for, well, maybe it's a fine line.
Chair Green,
how many don't get through, though, ultimately?
Yeah.
3% get
reviewed. Chair Greenlick, Representative Bruin, about 6 may get denied, but I want to point out to you.
6%?
No, 6 total applications. But what I want to point out to you is that.
Out of what?
Out of 1,000. What I want to point out is that doesn't mean that someone would not be licensed with some type of a limitation or a need to go to our health professionals program based upon a history of substance use that needs to be treated and monitored. So I could get you the figures on those additional types of limitations in terms of licensure at the outset.
And really the only point, Mr. Chair, was just to say if we, given your real concern, real consideration, how big in the field, if we're looking at short-term licensure, we're really talking about. We're talking about 10% or 1%. So.
You done?
I am.
Yeah, Cannon to that.
Okay, and then Representative.
Representative Garrett?
Oh.
Then Representative Kenmer, and then Representative Cannon.
Nope.
Sorry.
I was...
Kotex in the middle.
For him. I'm
sorry. Right. Never mind.
Thank you.
Correct.
Mr. Chair. I agree that the bill, as it's worded now, doesn't seem to give the board the ability to deny a limited application if there's an actual problem with the doctors in another state. Couldn't we add language giving the board the ability to make essentially a background check phone call to the other state's board, and if there's actual notice of a problem, then deny it? Wouldn't that go a long way towards solving your problem?
We could put D under on page 20. That would require them not to be under the investigation of that board. Problem is, the investigations sometimes take a long time, but they don't pop out, and I think you could find out, couldn't you, if they were currently being investigated?
Chair Greenlick, that's part of what we do through this application process, is find out if they're under investigation either at the hospital or the board.
I was just talking about the board.
Oh, in terms of the board, yes.
We could add that.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Garrett, I just want to make you aware that some folks have 30 licenses in other states. So there is an issue in terms of it's not a simple phone call sometimes.
I think that's clouding the issue. And the issue is, are they competent? Are we leaving rural hospitals and rural practices without the ability to provide care? And it is so difficult to recruit physicians today that, on the margin, if there's a 6 in 1,000 chance, I'd much rather have a 6 in 1,000 chance as to have no one there when I crash and burn on I-84 or something. And at some point there is a risk analysis that needs to take place, and you take a risk maybe for 30 days or 60 days. And I've never known a doctor to walk in day one, a surgeon, and start cutting on day one. I mean, there's a spin-up time to before you start cutting.
When I was a pharmacist back in Detroit, there was a doctor in my neighborhood who was a complete fraud. And had been a complete fraud for 10 years. Was not a doctor at all. Eventually, they found him out. And the result was that the patients jammed the board demanding he be left in practice. I don't know if that's relevant to this or not.
Thank you. A little different topic. What's the basis for moving rural applicants to the top of the pile?
Chair Greenlick, Representative
Kenneman. All the screaming we've done.
Well, that's what I'm trying to catch up on.
One of the things I do in the interim is go out and visit with hospital administrators. And I've been hearing from hospital administrators how difficult it is to recruit in the rural areas. So what we did is boot them to the top of the pile.
So that's been an administrative decision rather than a legislative or a board decision?
Chair Greenlick, it's a... Representative Kenemer, it's a board decision.
Certainly blessed by us.
Okay. Just trying to understand.
Representative Cannon?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a little more, can you characterize the 6 out of 1,000 a little more? How many of those are applications that come in with evidence of a full unrestricted license to practice medicine in another state? So if we were to apply, because it sounds like it may even actually be a smaller pool than that, perhaps some of those 6 do not have blemished licenses, lost licenses in other states. Is that the case?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cannon, I'd be happy to get you the background on those applicants that were ultimately denied. I do want to also make you aware that we would be the first state to do this, and I know Oregon likes to be a pioneer. However, I also don't want to see Oregon become the magnet for those folks who are under investigation in other states to say, well, I know I can go and get a limited license in Oregon.
And Mr. Chair, just a comment. I do appreciate Kathleen's concern here for the safety of patients, ultimately. And I think it's important to acknowledge while this committee and its predecessors may have sent strong signals about the need to accelerate, you know, rural medicine and create more accessibility in rural communities, we've also sent pretty strong signals to our boards about their need to protect patient safety. And obviously, it's a balance, you know, this bill presents kind of a dilemma along those lines. But I think it's hardly inappropriate for a board to come before us and say, you know, look, we're going to take every step, even including slowing down this process in order to ensure, you know, patient safety. So
we should note for the record, Representative Cannon is being nice to the witness because she's his constituent.
Well, that's true. But that's
Representative Cote.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kathleen, how many applications for rural locations have been given priority order in the last 12 months? Mm-hmm. Do we know? I mean, how many are we talking about here?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, I would need to check on that, but I'm thinking in the vicinity of about 25.
Thank you.
Yes, I'll just make a comment, and I have no doubt about it. When you made your original comments, I picked up on that question too. I mean, I have no doubt about the acute need in rural communities, but it seems with the current system that what we're doing is we're slowing down the process for the rest of the state as we accelerate the process. So we're not solving any problems with this method. Although with the tools we have with the current licensure, it's the only thing we can do is put them at the top of the list. But Portland and Salem and Eugene are negatively affected by that. So.
I do want to make a comment, and in the earlier committee, the Subcommittee on Human Services, chaired by Representative Kotek, we've been talking about key performance indicators of different groups, and Ms. Haley knows I'm very much interested in having as a key performance indicator that total time, that 75-day median, and finding ways to reduce that total time. So I think we have the systemic problem, and then we have a patch on the problem for some issues, and I think they're as committed as we are to move that to speed that whole process up within, as Representative Cannon says, the limits of safety. We have, in fact, been beating on all the boards to put public safety in the fore, so this is a tough balance thing. Okay. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Representative Benz, will you join us with, you have some folks with you, I think? Sorry to keep you waiting.
Mr. Chair, while we're waiting.
Yep.
How difficult would it be to do the kind of risk analysis that the good vice chair has mentioned? I do think it's a question of, I'm not a statistician, so, you know, if we know we have about X number of applications every year, and you know, there is a public safety issue, but, I mean, what is the risk? How difficult would that kind of analysis be to do?
Well, you ring my researcher hat, and I'd say if we could randomize a few states to doing it this way versus the current way, you might actually be able to see what the issue is. And to a certain extent, that's a serious question, because I think Ms. Haley's last statement was an important one. If we do this, we change the circumstance. And then, in fact, we may be enhancing that. I mean, that's always a worry, but it is, I think it's something we have to be looking at very seriously. Representative, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and thank you for inviting us here today. Thank you for having this hearing on House Bill 2435. For the record, I'm Cliff Bentz. My district is District 60, which is Malheur County, Harney County, portion of Grant County, and all of Baker County. The problem that HB 2435 addresses is one that has been a problem in my district, and in particular my hometown of Ontario, for many years. I'm a lawyer practicing for 31 years in that town, and I've represented our local hospital, Holy Rosary Medical Center, for 20 of those 31 years. This difficulty in licensing was a constant and remains a constant problem, and our purpose today isn't to say who is causing the problem so much as to bring before you kind of the scope of the problem and then the issues that arise from the problem. So our hope is that with the two folks that I've asked to come over from Holy Rosary Medical Center today, flying in from drive to Boise, fly to Portland, drive down to Salem, so they're here. And they're Robin Burns, the medical staff manager for, I think, 15 years at Holy Rosary Medical Center, and Judy Cordinez, there we go. I still probably have that wrong, don't I? The executive director of quality and business development at the hospital. I want to say that the last thing we want, and I've been through the peer review process, I've been through the hearing process, I've been through the delicensure process in my law practice, and the last thing we want are doctors without appropriate qualifications appearing in the small towns across eastern Oregon. But we know that without these physicians, we won't have small towns in eastern Oregon, because without a doctor and without a hospital, you don't have a town. And so the balance that we folks are being asked to make here is, of course, slightly on the side of patient safety, but I think there are ways of doing the limited license, such as has been suggested in the bill, that will provide for that protection. But again, I think the place to start might be for Judy to present the general overview of where we find ourselves as a small town hospital, and then to Robin to kind of give a scope of the problem.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Chairman Greenlich and members of the Healthcare Committee, my name is Judy Cordonese, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2435. First of all, let me tell you, it is an honor to have traveled across the state to be here to represent Holy Rosary Medical Center. And I always say that I am in rural health care by design, not by default. And I think that rural health care deserves the quality of people that that require the staunchness to carry the flag and give the representation that the folks in the rural communities deserve. And so I, too, would never put my patients and community at risk with providers that would not give them top quality care. I also am responsible for risk management in our hospital. I wear lots of hats, as you can tell, and to subject a patient to quality of care that's less than top-notch is not something, number one, we could afford to do from a malpractice situation or from a PR perspective, or that our medical staff would dare allow to happen from their own purview would be unheard of. We, before we even submit a physician's application to the board for review, do our own internal application process as a part of their becoming a member of the medical staff. This is required by the Joint Commission on Accreditation. It's required by the conditions of participation by the federal government for Medicare reimbursement. So there are other standards and other requirements that we must fulfill in addition to state licensure. And those require from us a review by the American Medical Association, which is a verification of licensure in every state, a verification of their education, both medical and undergrad, an OIG for sanctions. We look through and receive DEA information. We go to the National Practitioner Data Bank. Additionally, we personally, by the facility, verify state licensure in the states that they indicate. We also look at any variances. If the AMA submits back to us a document and we find variances between what we've received from the state, we personally, as a facility, look into that as well. And we personally don't take what the AMA says. We do our own verification by the National Data Bank. Additionally, when we do our references, we attach a picture of the provider. We take the picture of the provider, put it on the letter, send it to all of these folks and say, is this the John Doe that you know is the John Doe? So that there's no question about who we're talking about here. This is something we've done now for several years because we heard that, gee, people might not be who they say they are. So we send a picture just to make sure. This is all outside of what the state is doing for licensure purposes. So there's lots of other things going on in addition. Besides that, our physicians are proctored before they're allowed to be, quote-unquote, cut loose and attend to patients on their own. So there's a lot of internal work that's done to make sure that providers are quality providers, not just state licensing. So I thought that's important for you to know that those sorts of things are happening as well. I guess the second point that I would like to emphasize, and it's already been spoken to here today, is the fact that there are many opportunities and fewer providers, so that there are a lot of options for providers when they come through and they're shopping for a place to land. And it's like any big sales job, you have to be very efficient in selling your position that you have open. And any obstacle that gets in the way of that sales job or anything that might delay it is a good reason for them to buy and go somewhere else. So we try to be very efficient and very expedient when we are selling the practice and we're selling our community to a provider. And it's all sales, and we try to do the best that we can. And that's why we are so supportive of this sort of change in the process. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Robin Burns, and I thank you for the opportunity to come testify today in support of House Bill 2435. I've been credentialing for the hospital for 15 years. I take great pride in that, and it's like being a private investigator. And there has been delays ever since I've been credentialing there with the Oregon Medical Board. And it's not pointing fingers at who's doing wrong. It's just there are significant delays, and it takes up to 6 months to get a license. In most cases, rarely does it happen quicker than that. And so this places a huge burden on our current medical staff, our primary care physicians. If we can't get physicians recruited in, to help alleviate and take care of some of these patients. It's going to burn our current physicians out.
Six months? Did I hear you just
yes,
say 6 months?
Yes, it can take up to 6 months, and that's more the norm than not.
Okay, I need to have, that's pretty, that's, there's a big delta between what you just said.
Well, up to 6 months, that's why I was asking for the range that they had, up to 6 months.
Up to 6 months.
Okay, but you just said before that, you
that
said
is,
that is the routine, that's the average.
That I would say that's an average. We've had physicians much longer than that to get an organ license.
Okay. Can we have that substantiated?
Yeah, sure. Okay. For instance, on the paper that we handed out, an emergency physician that we just recruited, we started interviewing him in July. He submitted his application in October, and just the beginning of February received his license from the Oregon Board.
When did he submit?
October. So that may...
Just so, to follow up, the application requires them to submit multiple pieces of information. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that when you say October, presumably that was when the applicant submitted the first piece of information. Perhaps some of the delay in some cases might be the fact that they need extra time to gather their other materials required for submission.
Representative Greenlick and Representative Cannon. From my understanding, what they do is they submit their organ licensure application to the state, and then what they have to do is they have to send their references out themselves to their medical school, their residency, all the information that the board requires. It is then up to the medical schools and all these others to send in verifications to the board. Now, if you look at Dr. B, the OBGYN, she sent in the application. She sent all her documentation out to these places that needed to be verified. These places say that they have mailed them in. When we check, the board says they have not received it. So then when we call back to the medical school, for example, they say, well, we have done it. Well, they're not going to issue a license without that. So we ask them again, would you please do a second request for us? And so they'll do that. And sometimes that goes up to three times that the board does not receive those things. And so all that holds up the whole entire application process. And as you can see, Dr. B, there were several things sent out and duplicated as well.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Great testimony. With your experience with this, and we're talking about a competitive disadvantage, I mean, that was the heart of your testimony in the sales project, competitive disadvantage. Are people beginning the process, in your experience, are people, doctors, beginning the process, getting halfway through it, throwing up their arms because they've applied something, they've applied in Tennessee or Texas, and they're done, so they go, okay, I'm going here because they've done it? Or is it a factor of people realizing, you're talking to folks, you're recruiting folks out of the state, obviously, and they're starting to do some investigation, and they realize it's going to take 3 to 6 months to do this, and it's like, well, I'm going to go to Texas once again. Is that, or is it a combination of both?
Chairman Greenlick and Representative Bruin, that has happened, yes.
Both scenarios. What's the norm? Is it people throwing up their arms halfway through?
No, I think that they
are people just not applying in the first.
First place. We have had one person do that, not that has thrown their hands up halfway through, but more that they have talked to other physicians or they've looked at the application, then talked to physicians in Oregon and have decided to go elsewhere.
Gotcha. Thank you.
The flaw in our notion here is that in four of your cases, or five, the OMB never acknowledged receiving the application. So
that's correct.
If that's the case, it wouldn't be a limited or any other license. That wouldn't be solved here. We need to find out how to deal with that one, but that's a significant issue, right?
Well, the application is received by them.
Oh, okay.
the actual application is received by them. On Dr. C, the OBGYN, we recently had a physician take a fellowship at OHSU. The administrative assistant for the OBGYN fellowship actually hand-carried the application to the Oregon Medical Board, received a receipt that they received it, and then they turned around and said they never received it. So we had to gather all that information again and go through that process.
When was that?
That was about 6 months ago, 8 months ago, within the last year, within the last 8 months. So by them not receiving this stuff, and you know, it's not to point fingers, I don't know where it goes, we have to resupply that information.
Won't help that situation. If we somehow can't make sure the application gets there, then the temporary license won't be issued any more than the permanent will.
Right? In that particular case, that's correct.
A little frustrating, huh?
It is very frustrating.
Who we got? Representative Maurer and then Representative Kotek.
Thank you. Back to the safety, which seems to be kind of the crux of the conversation, is when they are ready to practice in your hospital, how from the day they walk in the door, how long before they are essentially cut loose to practice on their own, whether they're a surgeon, I mean, from...
If we, let's say, I'm sorry, Chair Greenleg and Representative Maurer, if, let's say, it was a surgeon, it would be the first five cases, surgical cases, major surgical cases, and it would be the first five inpatients, surgical cases. So if you were following them for gout or something like that. So they would have to be proctored by another surgeon on staff that has those full privileges. They would have to be proctored by them. They would stay there the entire case to make sure that they are truly competent. Five cases for a surgery, depending on how fast they got busy, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. We also have in place that they cannot take solo call until such proctoring is complete. That way they are, you know, they can share call and go with the other surgeon, but they cannot take solo call until such time that we prove that they are competent.
Chairman Greenleg, Representative Maurer, additionally, when you have a small medical staff like we have in our rural areas, they keep a pretty close watch on their flock. And everybody pretty much knows the caliber and capability of the other physicians, and it doesn't take too long for the word to get out if someone's level of care isn't up to what they expect it should be. And they will round on each other's patients in short order to make sure that the level of care is what they expect in the facility and throughout the medical staff.
Senator Kotek?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here. I'm really glad you made the effort to come all the way to Salem. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm really impressed with the background work you do. Do you do all of that work before you make the offer to someone to come join your staff, or is it kind of a combination?
Chairman Greenleg and Representative Kotek, we do a lot of it. We want to make sure that we don't just get a warm body. We want to get a good fit. And we do a lot of the peer reference and hospital checks, especially before we make an offer, to make sure that the individual that we're getting is of the characteristic that will fit within the medical staff organization. And primarily from those sorts of character references, you can begin to get a take on whether or not that person will be a good character fit in the medical staff and in the medical staff organization. You don't want someone who's not going to fit well within a small group of a medical staff. It's not a good success rate because of that. And then we do some preliminary nuts and bolts, as Robin alluded to, before we get to the offer capacity.
Mm-hmm. Okay, a follow-up?
Yes.
And would you, do you think that's common practice for other rural hospitals? Did they go to that length as well, or do you think you're unique?
I would say yes, Chair Greenlich and Representative Kotek. I would say absolutely. As Judy alluded to earlier, we have certain requirements that we have to follow, Joint Commission standards, federal rules and regulations, and those things have to be done regardless of the state getting their organ license. We must do those things. So I would say they do. Mm-hmm. I think they're in the same boat we are. It's a small medical staff. We live there. These are our neighbors, and we want to make sure that our neighbors are taken care of.
I'd like to tag on to that, Chairman Greenlich and Representative Kotek. Additionally, with the employment, more and more employment of physicians, we have an additional risk of employing a physician who could possibly not turn out exactly the way we wanted, and now they are a huge risk to us. So we are even more conscious about making sure that our investment is a worthwhile investment. So we would want to do extreme due diligence in our employment hire.
Makes sense. And Mr. Chair, the reason I was asking these questions is because I hear from the board, you know, the challenge of creating a process like this that's in the bill right now and somehow opening the floodgates of every person out in the rest of the country who thinks, oh, I have an easy road to go to Oregon. But there's an overlay here of rural hospitals involved in this. So, I mean, do we alter the bill as such that insert the rural hospital review process as well, saying if you have been started to be reviewed for a hospital and a hospital wants to bring you in, I mean, that's a smaller pool of people. I'm not saying that's perfect, but that's a smaller group of folks than every physician out in the rest of the country who wants to come here and somehow have less of an oversight. So Because it sounds like what we heard from Representative Roblin, that there are rural hospitals. He was also speaking about, I know it's not only a hospital situation, but they're doing oversight. You add that to the preliminary oversight from the board. Is that enough to get us rolling down, to get them here sooner?
Well, what I'd like to present, Kotek, is I'd like to get both of these bills moving towards our ability to consider them. And I'd like to ask if I could ask Representative Thompson to work with Roblin and whoever else we need to get 2361 ready to go. If there are anything that needs to go in that, you can bring that back, and we can debate it. We'll set it for a work session. We can see how the board feels that. And Representative Harker, could I ask you to work with Representative Benz and Roblin to perfect 20 and with Ms. Haley to perfect 2435?
Sure.
Get that ready for us, and as soon as they're ready, we'll hear them. I'd also like to make sure the OMA was in my office about this one, but they're not here, didn't sign in, so it would be good if you would also check in with them. They have some ideas on this as well. And I'd like to have serious consideration for moving both of them as soon as we can. Thank you very, very much. We love when citizens come to see us, and when they come from a different time zone, we like it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, thank you very much.
I'll close the hearing on House Bill 2435. I think I already closed the other one, did I?
Yes, you did.
Okay, and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2009. We're going to have an ex-senator with us in one of these moments, but right now we have a distinguished dean to kick off these discussions. Dean Richardson, you better watch out who you hang out with.
I am Dr. Mark Richardson, dean of the OHSU School of Medicine, and Chairman Greenlich and members of the House Healthcare Committee, I am very grateful and appreciative of the opportunity to provide OHSU's perspective on healthcare reform. I also want you to note that we do help provide workforce to Ontario, Oregon, and also deliver service excellence in terms of hand-carrying applications to the OBME.
There's customer service for you.
You know they got it.
I think we all realize that our healthcare system has failed in one of its fundamental purposes, and that's to support the health and well-being of every Oregonian. Not coincidentally, that is part of the mission statement of OHSU. We believe that although health care reform is a complex issue, we really can't delay any longer, and we must get started in terms of solving the problems that face us. And the economic crisis makes it even more imperative at this particular point in time. We strongly support health care reform and the efforts of your committee and want to offer our partnership with you to make this reform a reality. Last year, we published 8 principles of health care reform, which are in my written testimony, along with other information for your review. Many of these 8 principles are reflected in the work of the Health Fund Board and what you're trying to accomplish. But I'd like to focus on 2 aspects of health care reform, the provider tax and the role of education. One of the key questions I think that we all face is how do we fund health care reform? Successful reform will initially require new money in the system, and a provider tax is one way of raising those funds that are necessary. So do we support that? Yes, we do. But I think it's important to also make sure that the provider tax is constructed in the proper way, and I'd like to offer 3 things for your consideration. We do support universal access, and perhaps by broadening the tax, we can actually cover more individuals. If we can go beyond just hospitals, insurers, maybe there is more that we can do by bringing everyone under coverage sooner rather than later. We're certainly concerned about the impact of a provider tax on our healthcare workforce, and we would like to request that the committee consider including a plan to regularly evaluate the impact of the tax and to mitigate, if needed, any unintended consequences on our physicians or other provider capacity. And 3, I'd like to make sure that we consider its impact on OHSU's education mission. Unlike any other hospital or health system in Oregon, our clinical revenue directly supports our educational mission. If a provider tax reduces our clinical revenue, it will directly impact our ability to educate the next generation of physicians and other providers. We ask that the committee consider OHSU's unique situation and discuss ways to offset the impact of a provider tax, not only on those directly responsible for payment, but for missions that are subsidized through those revenues. That brings me to my 2nd point, which I want you to consider, and that is the necessity of investing in provider education. Clearly, successful reform will depend upon those providers. And these men and women will play a major role in whether or not reform actually works. And we should consider the following questions. Will we have enough providers? Will they be distributed geographically appropriately? Will they be trained in the needed specialties? And will they have been trained to focus on preventive care, to practice in medical homes, to be part of a team of providers? Will they be trained to be always looking for ways to reduce costs? And we must, I think, invest in education in ways that support the vision of healthcare reform and what we want our healthcare system to be. So we request that the committee include a plan for education that explicitly defines the attributes of a provider workforce that will support our vision for healthcare, for our healthcare future, and ensure successful reform, and identifies ways to fund that education in a sustainable fashion. Thank you. And I'll try and answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Well, I have a couple. I can hardly not ask you, Dean, a couple of questions. you have specific words on that latter thing that you think might be on that manpower piece that we might find a way to specifically deal with it?
Please, Chairman Greenlick, explain what
you're proposing. We put in your 2nd thing. We put in something about
what type of provider Yes, I think...
Provider education in the room. What I'm saying is, do you have some specific legislative, a specific legislative proposal that we could drop in if we all agree to and put it into the bill that would get you where you want to go?
I think...
That's not a facetious question. That's a serious question.
I'm taking it very seriously. We think that our vision for health care reform, similar to yours, is going to, again, focus on those preventive care measures, looking at management of medical teams. And I think if we're going to have our provider workforce being able to do that, we need to change, to a certain extent, our educational mission, and we need to make sure that we funded that appropriately. I'd be happy to help design what our future providers should look like along with this committee.
Well, you have a concept that you think ought to be considered. I'm always interested in how to turn concepts into legislative language. And the question is this something we should be looking at and worrying about in the future, which we all are, or is there a specific proposal that would amend 2009 or one of the companion bills that would specifically address what you're trying to address? And you don't need to answer that now, but the extent to which you could literally say, here's an amendment to 2009 or to 2132 or whatever those other numbers are, that would be very helpful for us to consider.
Okay.
And I have a second question, but I hear Representative Kotek has a question. I'll be back. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for being here. My question would be, just listening to your line of questioning, what would your thoughts be if we decided to make an amendment to 2009 that said reimbursements to the university for graduate medical education will only be paid for primary care training and education? You think that would how would that work?
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the implications of that would be, Chairman Greenlick and Representative Kotek, but I think I'd have to look at it. I'm very proud of the outcomes that we have at OHSU in terms of the interest of our students in primary care and our ability to have them settle in Oregon and fulfill some of the workforce needs. If, however, that proposal that you just stated impacted our ability to deliver education, or we all know that primary care is vital, but that's not to say that we don't have mental health care needs, obstetrics and gynecology, as we just saw, and other specialty care needs in the state that need to be addressed as well. I'd hate to see anything suffer in any of our missions as a result of one focal point or another.
Well, thank you. I'm assuming we'll keep talking about this, but thank you for your response. Appreciate it.
Yeah, that's response to the... We're hearing a lot that there are too many specialists in the state and not enough primary care, although that's a geographic issue as well. I mean, I don't think there are too many ophthalmologists in eastern Oregon. But, so I think these kind of questions are in aid of what can we do to stimulate the development of more primary care docs and perhaps fewer tertiary care docs. But I think your point is taken, that we can't have full-blown Category 1 emergency room somewhere because we can't get neurosurgeons to provide 24-hour coverage in many parts of the state and things like that. Let me ask you a very specific question about the provider tax. I hear you saying you don't only want to be taxed at OHSU on your hospital side. You'd like also to be taxed on your physician delivery service. And I think that's an admirable, I mean, I think it's an unselfish position, and not all physician groups have taken that position yet. But specifically about the hospital tax, you all are members of the Hospital Association, and while we believe every hospital in the state would benefit the hospital tax that we have, you all might benefit even more than some of the others. Is that given that? Do you support the hospital tax as we propose it, even though you might prefer some other model?
Well, let me start off by saying that I support the broadest possible support for equal access and access for all. And that's why I want to broaden it. our hospital actually, through our own calculations, would not fare well under the current provider tax as it's constructed. And we have our
construction in 2009, or as the Hospital Association pretends it's constructed?
As the figures that we have worked with so far indicate. So I think what we're trying to work with right now is our financial people are working with DMAP to look at the current construction and hopefully assure ourselves that, in fact, we would be neutral in this particular proposal.
But we should put you down in favor of taxing physician services as well as hospitals.
I'm in favor of incorporating as many people under our health care reform umbrella as we can possibly manage to do.
Thank you.
I would suggest that that may be somewhat self-serving because you're the one to benefit from the increased, you know, pot of money. And I think I'm going to make a comment. I think that the most disturbing part of the provider tax, as the conversation is evolving, is that this is, it's about, let's just, we need just more money to build coverage before we've even implemented anything about cost containment, cost control. And once we throw the money in and we create this additional revenue, then what's the incentive to bend the curve? There's no incentive to bend the curve. I want to bend the curve.
I'd say the 200,000 people we added would provide us some incentive because they'll now have access to health insurance that they didn't have before. And with every bit of data we have, that means they'll end up getting better care. So, I mean, that's a very important incentive. Now, do we have to bend the curve? You betcha. We're there together on that one, certainly. But it's not one or the other.
Well, I'm sorry.
We're having a debate here rather than getting testimony. We're going to have plenty of time for this debate, and we have it all the time. Dean Richardson, thank you very much for coming over.
Thank you.
And I now call for the next panel Dean Kortko and Roger Beyer and Dave Fiskum. And, Senator, I'm sorry we held you up.
No problem.
We just lost a piece of our committee to full ways and means, trying to figure out how to cut things out of the budget so we can survive this fiscal year.
Mr. Chairman, my name and members of the committee, my name is Dean Kortko, and I'm here representing today the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors of Oregon to their Professional Insurance Agents Association across the state. I've been past president of that association. I've been a 27-year veteran of the health insurance wars in Eugene, and most recently served, appointed by the governor, to be on one of the committees of the Oregon Health Fund Board, so I got to be a part of that process. NAFA Oregon has solemn concerns about the establishment of Section 18 of the Health Insurance Exchange, and it is proposed, quoting from the bill, it will serve as the conduit for the purchase of all individual and small group health insurance in Oregon. So this will be the single place to go to buy all the insurance across the state of Oregon. It's assumed that the state can make these policies in this market more stable and can develop insurance policies that will cost less than is done in the current market, and therefore being able to increase the number of people insured. So we're going to submit the following data for your consideration. The first set of data comes from the Oregon Health Fund Board, which came part out of the committee that I worked on. So these numbers, of course, move, as we know. But using the number of 600,000 uninsured, this is a number that's close enough for government work for now. Of that number, 116,000, give or take a few, are kids, which is being proposed and has been proposed in the last session to be covered, funded by the cigarette tax. So we take 116,000 off the uninsured rolls. That leaves 484,000 adults. Of the 484,000 adults, our committee came up with 48% of that number is at or under 200% of the federal poverty level. According to the studies that we did, at or under 200% of the federal poverty level, in fact, even higher for some, they simply don't have disposable income to buy health insurance policies today. So therefore, they need your support. That leaves 251,000 Oregonians who don't have health insurance, who can afford it. Currently, we already have 246,492 Oregonians who've already bought this insurance. So therefore, the numbers really aren't as dramatic when we talk about providing a private policy solution to this problem as the 600,000, because we're going to have to fund those other 400,000 in some way. And that comes from the Oregon Health Fund Board report data. The second piece of data just got reported from the Health Insurance Division, the Department Division of Consumer Business Affairs. From 2005 to 2007, the individual market, number of people enrolled in individual policies, grew by 20%, while the small group market grew only by 1.6%. Interestingly enough, the average for 2003 to 2007, the average increase in premium was only 12.8%. Keep in mind, we're talking about health care. If we were talking about rocket science, we could solve this problem, but it's health care. But small group market increased by 13.9%. Furthermore, we talk about the use of commission. The commission paid on all those products for the entire year was 2.7% of every premium collected. Furthermore, for 2007, the data included in this report, for every dollar of premium collected, 90 cents was paid in claims. 90 cents average for all of the companies. So that comes from the Department of the Division of Business Consumer Affairs. So it's not the premiums that's driving up the cost, it's the care that's driving up the cost. I apologize on page 2 of my written testimony, paragraphs 4 and 5 are redundant. It's a kid from the Dells who still doesn't know how to use his WordPerfect program very well. But let me just jump on furthermore in section 25 of the bill. It's very clear to me as a reader what the intent of this bill is. It says, the legislative finding is that the existing health insurance market forces do not permit the market to operate in a cost-efficient manner or to ensure the availability of health care throughout the state. That justifies the establishment of exchange. I would debate that point and suggest that finding is probably not accurate. So we'd suggest that if the exchange is going to be funded, it not be funded as a bureaucracy where people will go to buy health insurance. It would be funded as a way to collect premiums. If premiums are going to be in some way from state funding, from individual funding, perhaps even a payroll tax has been discussed, could be a way to fund that money, but as a way to provide brand new place for people to go buy health insurance, simply, in our opinion, doesn't work. So we'd rather suggest a way in which we try to find a way to get an additional 150,000 people enrolled in the individual marketplace. We would suggest by that kind of a number, we reach a tipping point pretty soon. It becomes something people do. If you analyze the data on that 250,000, at least from being in the business for 27 years, most of the people in that bracket who don't have health insurance are people under the age of 40. Those are people who don't want to buy it. That's pretty simple. They would rather do anything else rather than buy health insurance. So somehow that has to be encouraged as a way in which they want to do that. I'd answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
I do just want to point out, we forwarded to the committee some proposed amendments to many sections. I think about 52 pages of amendments or something. Not that they're full of pages, but we try to format that way, including a pretty significant rewrite of Section 18, where I think we talk about a couple of specific things that the exchange should do, and then a list of things to consider for the authority to consider to refer to us with an exchange package at the next session. And, of course, one of those that we move to the consider category, I think, is whether or not all individual and small group coverage ought to be handled through the exchange or not. So, I mean, I think that takes some deliberation and some discussion. And I think we've removed the language, the finding that Fiskum particularly found several little hairy has left on fire about the... it wasn't Fiskum, it was somebody else.
Mr. Becker, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
I seconded the motion, however.
Yes, it was. So I think you can look for... which went to the committee today, the set of them, and they'll be available or anybody wants them, on a whole set of things that Representative Maurer and I tried to work out to get things that we could all agree needed to change and still have plenty of things we could continue to argue about.
Mr. Chair, I apologize if I'm redundant then. I only read what I read, and so there you have it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Quick question. Sir, the number 600,000 uninsured Oregonians is routinely spouted.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to, the issue is not debating that number. But you kind of hinted at it a little bit. Of the 600,000, do we have any idea how many of those are uninsured but could afford it?
Well, the best, Mr. Chair, Chairman Greenlick, the best data we had came from the committee that I served on, and we had to project that because we really, as you suggest, don't have really good hard data on who these people are. So that's where we came up with this number, 48% of, or 20, looking at my data, 48% of adults in this bracket are at or under 200% of the federal poverty level. Okay. And that's the data from our committee that's in the report that suggests at a family of four at 200% of federal poverty level, I think is what, $28,000 or something like that, and there's just not disposable income in our judgment that allows you to house a family and feed them and get to work and buy health insurance. So that's the logic behind how I came up with that data. And that's contained in the health fund report.
And that's really an important question from where we, I mean, let's assume we get to 200,000 and find a way to do that now. It's a pretty significant task next for the board to say, or in this case we hope the health authority board to say, well, here's a plan for going from that to the objective, which I think in the report is 90% of that 600,000 by 2015, and that is going to take something. And of course then we have the problem that we might take 200,000 people in under the plan in 2009 and because of economic conditions end up with 600,000 uninsured. That I think is a scenario that's possible.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You know, I appreciate the information about the rates and the premiums and the increases, but you really can't talk about that in isolation from the quality of the insurance, right? you know, that is, the size of the deductibles, the copays, et cetera. And so there may be some differences there between the private insurance and the small group insurance that, you know, that that can be attributed to. Also, I would say that a lot of the people who are choosing not to buy insurance are doing it specifically because of the cost of the deductible, the size of the deductibles and the copays, they feel, and the exclusions that they would be subject to. So this is a very complicated issue, and you can't really just look at the cost in isolation.
Chairman Greenwald, Representative Demarest, it's absolutely correct. And one of the things we've found, and I've certainly found over the last 27 years of doing this, that health insurance has really come not to be risk protection. It's come to be a commodity, and particularly in my experience, a person in the age bracket of 25 to 40 who grew up having stuff for their from their family with a $10, even a $5 copayment, and they come now and they want to buy insurance, and they go, my God, I have to have a $1,000 deductible before I can do anything, and they freak out. They forget that you can go in the hospital for your routine colonoscopy and spend 3.5 weeks there. As my cousin just got out of the hospital 2 days ago, $1,000 deductible is a relatively insignificant matter. So it's a matter of that risk concept. It really is different. And so we've moved away from when I grew up that you bought health insurance because you didn't want to spend $5,000 or $3,000 or whatever. It's risk protection. And now it's if I have to spend at all, and when I go to a doctor, not have only a $20 copayment, I just don't want to buy it. You're right. And you're also very accurate when we use those numbers to apply to the small group market, to the individual market. Yeah, a lot of people insure their kids. Very smart. Why not insure a kid for $68 a month instead of paying $200 a month on a group policy? Well, $68 goes a long way to keeping those average premiums down. But it's still insurance. They're still buying insurance to protect against what they want. Are they buying the fancy-dancy plan? No, because they have to pay for it. So there is an educational component part here that has to be conveyed. Absolutely agree with you.
It'd be very useful to have a discussion on the nature of health insurance. I mean, seriously, and maybe we can find a way to get an informational discussion on that, because health insurance is very different than casualty insurance, and there are these two trains, the service plans versus the indemnity plans, and they're very different philosophies than, and one isn't insuring against a financial risk, it's promising to provide a service, and they're very different philosophy. Yes, sir.
Representative Kenemer.
I'm sorry, Representative Kenemer. I just wanted to follow up with someone, Representative Dimbros. I think one of the things that was implicit in what you said but not explicit is I'm talking to quite a few people who are finding pre-existing conditions, are making health insurance from people who have good incomes, in their view, unaffordable as well. So I think that's another real problem, and it seems to me that there seems to be a real influx of pre-existing conditions lists growing, if I may just editorialize.
Yeah, because as they lose insurance, they can't get something else. But
yeah.
I think the whole nature of the risk pool is an important part of that Section 18. And how do we create a risk pool that makes some sense?
Chairman Green, I represent Cameron. It's absolutely right. The largest percentage growth is in the Oregon Medicare Insurance Pool for those people who have pre-existing conditions, percentage-wise.
Well, but a lot of people don't know about it.
Right, and it's unfortunate.
It
is a place they can go.
Yes.
You know, definitely that. I think that part of the bill that talked about community rating really needs to be looked at. Hopefully it's one of your changes, because community rating means the same price for everybody. It's a great deal for an old geezer like me. But I'll tell you, some young kid at 22 is going to pay through the bloody nose when you have that. So that's a real problem to adjust for that.
I think that's the underlying. Senator Beyer, do you have something you want to add to this? And then we'll get Mr. Fiscom, who will
tell us how
hard the world is.
I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing NAFA also. And, Mr. Chair, NAFA greatly appreciated your remarks of at least two different hearings that I've been in on this bill, when you said that the bill does not necessarily reflect what you envision the system of the final product to look like, which is that the exchange would be the only avenue for small group or individual coverage.
I say that's simple. That's still an open question.
Absolutely, yeah. So Mr. Chair, I have submitted to the committee now, and prior to that, to Representative Maurer's office, some our proposed changes to sections that would reflect what NAFA would like to see in the bill when it comes to dealing with this issue of the exchange. You have that now before you. I would be happy to answer any questions anyone would have on those our proposed ideas. I wrote those up not in LC format, but as I think they would be easily to be read. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will just entertain any questions you may have and look forward to working with you as we go forward.
Thank you. Am I to gather from this that you're my constituent, though?
Mr. Chair, no, you would not.
There's a name on the top of the, an address on the top of it.
That would be the office of where the association is located.
So I represent NAFA, and I take that very seriously. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Fiscom.
Mr. Chair, committee members, appreciate the chance to appear here again this afternoon to talk to you about a major piece of legislation. For the record, Dave Fiscom, here on behalf of Providence Health System, which, as I've told you before, operates 7 hospitals around the state in a variety of communities, urban and rural, major health insurance plans, special programs, Providence Child Center in Portland, Providence Elder Place at 5 locations in the Portland area, as well as Providence Benedictine in Mount Angel. So we're involved on, if not a statewide basis, at least beyond the metropolitan area. Appreciate the chance to talk to you from Providence's vantage point. I'll do so in the form of submitting a letter, again, for the record, from the CEO of our system, Russ Danielson, who wishes he could be here today but could not. I should say that we do feel it is an obligation to submit comments for the record at these hearings, but especially today, I'm not sure how far to go because I know the hearing is advertised, they're covering all aspects of House Bill 2009, and at the same time, Mr. Chair, I have heard the possibility that next week or at some point you may allow for testimony specifically on funding mechanisms in the bill. And if that's the case, at your discretion, I might reserve some of my comments till then.
Okay, why don't
But I'm happy to talk about it today, and I felt we needed to put those comments in this letter for your review, not knowing about your future schedule. So
I really appreciate that, and we will do that. Dave. We'll have plenty of time to...
If there's time for that, I will let stand for the record, as well as your time, the comments from Mr. Danielson that talk about the impact of the new taxes, and I would emphasize to you just for a moment that these, as proposed by the governor, and there's lots of uncertainty about some of the characteristics of them, including the percentage, because the percentage is left blank in every bill I've seen relative to both the hospital and insurance tax. But those, as we estimate the... Then
we confused the enemies.
Chair, I would never say that.
But, you admit you're the enemy.
No, I didn't admit who the enemy was.
I'm trying to figure out if I should be confused or not.
Anybody who's confused. We can.
So,
absolutely, Dave.
We have estimated what we believe to be the cost on our system, and the information is on the Hospital Association website about the range of hospitals, and I'm sure the insurers have the same estimate, though not on the hospital website, perhaps, relative to those costs. So at the proper time,
the Health Fund
we'll
Board made available to the body a set of models for each hospital with a set of different assumptions. So every member of the legislature, I think, received that.
Mr. Chair, if you're referring to a letter I saw today to legislators dated February 9th, if I'm right in that, I literally just received that today, though.
I think we received it yesterday, is that right?
I should add for the record, and not that it's a big deal, not from the Health Fund Board, but from other sources. So we're just looking at that is my point, frankly. I've sent that to Providence to understand what Mr. McConnell apparently in a new study has done, and we'll take a look at that to see, because we have not done so yet. So with a future opportunity, I'll let stand the comments Mr. Danielson made for the record and just add a couple other quick points as I hurry to the conclusion here relative to his letter. And I should say, first of all, on the taxes, that I think you're aware of this, but we are working behind the scenes in private, the insurers and the hospitals, on alternative taxes. We have some principles that motivate those discussions, particularly with regard to the Health Leadership Task Force, an organization that's been put together at the behest of Oregon Business Council. Denise Hansel and John Lee were before your counterpart committee this week explaining some of the work that that group is doing. So, in fact, it's on the record, and there are a number of proposals that a wide group of folks, many of whom worked on the Health Fund Board proposals, are working on, including an alternative to a tax that would meet some principles: broad-based, sustainable. The proceeds are actually devoted to health care, an important principle, so that proceeds from a tax, if one is imposed, aren't diverted to other purposes, and sometimes that has happened in my memory, as well, that the payers agree to pay the taxes, and in some cases we have advocated, as in 2003 and 2007, in fact, sunsets on the taxes so we could have this kind of discussion about what the future might hold. Those principles are motivating our discussion, and we're trying to get ready, Mr. Chair, to come back to you and you legislative leaders to talk about alternatives that might exist.
All we can say is there's a train in the station waiting to leave, and it would be really useful if those folks produce a actual proposal before that train leaves the station. And
Mr. Chair, though others can do it too, admonition accepted.
If it comes on July 1st.
We're aware of the time frame of this legislative session, and we have applied, and we have recommended a sense of urgency, and I believe that message is received. I would just add beyond that, we are concerned, as I said the first time I appeared before you on Providence's behalf, about the cost of 2009, and I'll leave that stand. We do have a concern in particular about the state having the authority to purchase hospitals to, quote, stabilize costs, unquote.
That's going to be out.
And, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that. I should say...
We really do need to move on.
And I'll be very quick and just say I appreciate the chance to look at those amendments, and I will let the letter stand as it is. Thank you for allowing me to put it on your record.
They are proposed amendments.
Yes. I understand. We'll be happy to look at those at your discretion, Mr. Chair.
Four more people.
I have one quick question.
Okay.
Dave, have you begun to look at the impact of the... passage of SCHIP at the federal level, and in my rough calculations, it is going to have a $110 million biennial negative result in money in the healthcare pool for the state of Oregon. On the plus side, you get 42,000 kids covered for that $110 million.
Yeah, I guess the way I've been thinking of it is. We're now estimating it would take $600,000 to get $1 billion, $600 million. We should be able to do it for less now because the SCHIP match will be 3-1 rather than 1.5-1 or something like that.
Okay. Anyway, but the
yeah, it's going to have an impact.
3-1?
It's 25.
For every dollar.
You put in 25 and get 75 cents in addition. Isn't that?
I believe that's the case, Mr. Chair. We're looking at it. I don't have the answers today to your question, Representative Maurer, but we're looking at the same thing, and I believe there's still a match requirement, which is, of course, the challenge in any legislative session.
Because SCHIP is going to cost the state $20 million in actual revenue per year.
Well, yeah. I mean, but right now, if we put more kids in and they go into regular Medicaid, we put 40 cents in and get 60 cents back.
Right.
We put them into SCHIP, we put 25 cents in and get 75 cents back for that same dollar. So it's got a positive effect in that context. I don't see where there's any... Well, okay, let's talk about this.
Okay.
We've got two more panels that I want to move to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very important consideration. Can I call Don Legrand, is it?
Legrand.
And let's have Stephanie Thomas Sweet. Is that correct? Still here? Good. And then next I have Scott Winkles and Liz Baxter. Go for it.
Thank you, sir. Chairman Greenlake, the committee, appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk to you very briefly. My name is Don Legrand. I trained at OHSU. I've been a board-certified pediatrician in private practice for 25 years and currently the medical director of the Children's Community Clinic in Portland, a safety net clinic serving uninsured children. In this capacity, I've struggled to obtain needed services for desperately ill uninsured children. To my dismay, I've seen that in Portland, Oregon, today, a 20-year-old young man without insurance can suffer and nearly die, surrounded by some of the world's finest healthcare institutions. Oregon lacks a consistent, rational system to deliver health services to our citizens. Our current patchwork of insurance eligibility classes, defined by age, employment, marital status, and income, leaves thousands of Oregonians uninsured. Studies have consistently shown that patients with disorders such as asthma who receive primary care have fewer ER visits and hospitalizations and have better health outcomes. Without the access provided by health insurance, patients forego preventive care, receive little health education, fail to control their medical problems, and suffer poor outcomes. Uninsured patients are forced to rely on expensive emergency rooms. When I see a child in our clinic, it costs approximately $60. The same child seen in an emergency department for the same illness costs hundreds of dollars. The cost of this uncompensated care increases hospitals' operating costs and the insurance insurance rates of the entire society. This status quo is completely irrational and is destroying our nation's ability to sustain the health of our people. House Bill 2009 creates a comprehensive, rational system to provide access to care for all Oregonians. In doing so, it reduces the cost shifting of uncompensated care, which has produced a 260% increase in private health insurance premiums in Oregon over the past 10 years. More importantly, it will reduce the needless suffering of those who cannot receive the care they need
and provide dignity to all Oregonians. As a physician, I strongly support House Bill 2009 as an appropriate and ethical response to this problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, panel?
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Thomas-Sweet, and I'm a public policy advocate with Oregon Food Bank, and I'll keep my comments brief. We're giving testimony today in support of the expansions for health care for kids and for low-income adults, and I know that you had some hearings last week on those, and organizational policy doesn't always follow legislative policy, so we're here today. So
follow the same calendar.
Please put us on the record for the support for these portions of the bill. Oregon Food Bank is the hub of a statewide network of 20 regional food banks and about 919 local agencies. And the reason we're here today is because of the stories we hear from our clients every day about the reasons why they are in need of emergency food. So I have a few statistics on the handout that are provided here, and I'll just run over them very quickly. But last year, on average, 200,000 people ate a meal from an emergency food box, and 36% of those were children. And this is the first time we actually looked at the healthcare statistics of people who participated in our Hunger Factor survey, which looks at about 4,000 clients of our services. And of those surveyed, 41% of the adults and 24% of children had no health insurance. 56 reported medical hospital debts, and 58% of households reported delayed medical care, which was up from 53% in 2006 and 47% in 2002. So these are statistics through June 30th of 2008, and as you all know, in the economic crisis, we can imagine that those numbers are increasing dramatically, and anecdotally, we hear that from our stories as well. One of the things I did want to mention, I heard a number tossed around, and if I could just be so bold, the federal poverty level, actually, for a family of four in 2008 was $21,200. I heard some higher numbers. And just
talking about 200%.
200%, okay, so 100%. In our statistics, or our study, 67% of people in our surveys were living below 100% of the federal poverty level. So we just want to note that hunger is an income issue, and many of our folks are choosing between food and medical expenses for between medicine and getting nutritious fruits and vegetables on the plates of their families and kids. And just want to note our support and encourage you to make decisions in a timely fashion. Thank you so much for your time, and I'll respond to any questions.
I just want to comment about how important the job is you're doing, independent of the healthcare side. You guys are a part of that fragile net we have between total disaster and just a little bit of disaster. I admire it very much.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, and you know, I'm a teacher, I bring my students through the food bank, and the question that's so immediately apparent when they tour that facility is, why is this place necessary? So yes, the job they do, and why is it a warehouse, you know, four stories high, practically as big as a football field, that turns over every, I don't know what it is, I mean, it's every couple of months, the completely new food, and hopefully we begin to get at some of that through this kind of work.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming. Thank you, sir. Can we have Liz Baxter and Scott Winkles, is that? Is that correct?
Winkles,
yes. Hi. We haven't talked for a long time.
A couple of hours, sir.
I feel really bad that it's almost 5 o'clock, but thank you for allowing
for it,
the
Liz.
Time here. Chair Greenlich, Vice Chair Maurer, and Vice Chair Harker, and members of the committee. My name is Liz Baxter. I am the Executive Director of the Archimedes Movement, and I'm also on the board of Oregon Health Decisions, which both distributes and does statewide community education on Oregon's advanced directive. The Archimedes Movement is a member of the Oregon Health Reform Collaborative, where there's agreement that healthcare needs to be more affordable, available to all, and be focused on eliminating health disparities and improving the health of Oregonians. I believe that you have an opportunity to set the direction for Oregon's future healthcare system, one that creates several changes. First, that there are ways for us to share both the cost and the responsibility for the new system. Second, that there's a way for Oregon to spend its money more wisely. And lastly, that you create a framework that makes sense and actually meets the needs of Oregonians. But for me, it's much more than an argument about saving specific programs. For me, it's important to understand why what you're doing is as important as it is, in addition to understand what it is that you might get accomplished. So I have a story, and I'm going to try and do it in a very short period of time. It's going to be kind of hard. My partner and I have raised three boys who are now 14, 16.
Please take your time.
Really?
Really.
Thank you. We've raised three boys who are now 14, 16, and 27. And our youngest we adopted in the year 2000 after he had spent 6 years in and out of Oregon's foster homes. The two of us have both worked in the healthcare system throughout most of our careers, so we consider ourselves to be pretty savvy about how to get things done and how to navigate through the system. And we were fully aware when we adopted Nathan of the mental and physical challenges that he might face as he grew up. What we could not have envisioned is living at this three-way intersection of public education and special education services, the mental health system, and the medical system. When we talk about it at home, it is a three-way intersection where we're trying to go never gets a green light. There are difficult rules to follow. The rules change depending on every possible configuration and set of circumstances. Our youngest son has mental health issues that have resulted in multiple hospitalizations and intensive treatment plans. And in December, we had an experience with a discharge planning team from an inpatient unit where they called us one afternoon and said, "We're ready to discharge your son to the community to send him back home," even though they had made no referrals for community-based care upon his return home. And all of the team's decisions were based on this simple question: who would pay for what? This was not about lack of insurance coverage, because my son, because he came out of the foster care system, has both the OHP medical card and he has our private insurance. Yet, we have come to so many impasses because of the complexity of these rules. The options vary to every family and who's going to pay first and who's going to do what. And the landscape seems to change every time you ask a question. There is absolutely no ability to combine funding streams and to try and leverage available resources. There was and continues to be a lot of money that has been spent on the care for my son, just not in an integrated and coordinated manner, which, if we could change that, would undoubtedly result in less money being spent on his care. I don't want anybody to leave this room thinking Liz Baxter has just said that everybody has more than enough money to pay for mental health services. So I want to be very clear. The schools do not have enough funds to adequately take care of special needs kids. And I will be the first one to stand in line and tell you the mental health system is both underfunded and under-resourced. But my hope is that someday, and hopefully through this bill, House Bill 2009, that we can take a step back and ask ourselves whether what we are doing and what needs to be done can actually be done in a different way. So at one point during this discharge planning session, I was frustrated and confused enough that I did one of these timeout signs, and I asked the people who were sitting in the room, there were six staff people who were there, and I said, if the question was different, if we were not trying to figure out who would pay for what, but instead we were asking, what is in the best interest of this young man in order for him to achieve and be successful when he comes out into the community, would your recommendations for discharge be the same? And they went around the table, and six staff people said, absolutely not. That is a problem, and I believe that we can do better. The Archimedes Movement is advocating for a system that will improve the health of Oregonians, reduce per capita costs, and result in a better patient experience, using health outcomes and patient satisfaction as examples. Those are the same recommendations that were in the executive summary from the Oregon Health Fund Board. And so I encourage you as a committee to use that as your yardstick by which you will measure whatever it is that comes out of your work. We have a community leadership council, and they took the triple aim and they crafted a set of questions that as they go and talk to their legislators, they are hoping that these questions will actually frame the decisions that are going to be made. So for us, the question is not, is everybody covered by insurance? Instead, the question is, what is this insurance buy, and how do we deliver those services in the most efficient manner, cost, quality, and otherwise, to achieve the goal that we want to achieve? So the questions that we want you to ask Does this lead to improved health of the population? Does it lead to reduced per capita cost? Does it improve patient safety and lead to better patient outcomes? Is everyone involved held accountable for the investments that we're talking about making to the system? And will there be a way to know that these changes are actually working and moving us in the direction that we want to move? Not so long ago, the national media was focused on the bailout of the big three automakers. There was a lot of concern about what would happen if those automakers failed. What would happen to the local economy? What would happen to people who were dependent on that for their income? How would that affect the national economy? And I've yet to hear anyone say that in exchange for getting those federal funds, that those companies should change their production lines in order to start producing lower emission vehicles or vehicles that use natural or alternative fuels. In other words, building the car that we need tomorrow instead of continuing to build what they were building yesterday. Investments in a better health system are also investments in Oregon's economy, because those dollars result in local dollars, in jobs in local communities, and those workers then end up paying for other goods and services in their communities. This is all connected, and we are all connected. So I urge you, as you continue your deliberation on House Bill 2009 and the other bills before you, please move us towards the system that we want to have tomorrow, and see that the funds that we're talking about are investments in our future and a better health system. I actually believe that Oregonians are willing to follow you in making those investments if they can actually see what it is that they're buying for the dollars that you're asking them for. We can't afford to leave federal money on the table. Inaction is not going to leave us at status quo. It's going to take us back to a much darker time. And so, as we say in the Health Reform Collaborative, the time is now for health reform. Oregon can lead the way. And I would like you all to know that the Archimedes Movement is here to work with you and to help you, whether that's here in Salem or out in your districts. We would like to help you make this change. Thank you.
Boy, I don't have any comments. I think it's very important that we talk specifically about how the things we do. I was talking earlier to Representative Cannon, who was making almost the identical points you were making, to make sure that what it is we do gets us where we want to go. And that's going to be a charge to the Health Authority Board as they move forward, but we need to move the ball as far down the field as we can move it in that direction.
And Chair Greenlake, I guess part of where we feel like we could help you, you and the committee, is that it's incredibly important that Oregonians hear a story that they can understand about what it is that we want to do, not only what we want to accomplish, but when we talk about money, that they understand what it is that's being asked of them. So we're happy to help with that.
And we all have those stories. There isn't one of us that doesn't have firsthand account with a story like that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Scott, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record.
Tough act to follow, I got to tell you.
I'm sorry, I
put you in that position.
I recognize that, but I would say I'm very pleased and proud to share the table with Ms. Baxter. It's a compelling story. For the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. The League of Oregon Cities is pleased to say that we do support the intention in House Bill 2009 to bring uninsured money to the table. As an employer group, cities that do provide health care to their employees, we end up paying for the unrecoverable costs in higher premiums. Our employees pay them in their deductibles and in their co-pays. This is a situation where we would say cities would do well by doing good. It's necessary that we move forward. We do have some concerns over in other sections of the bill, however. Section 10, subsection 2A, the way it's currently constructed, we believe that the Oregon Health Authority could compel a local government into a self-insurance pool, even if it wasn't the will of a local government to do so. That's problematic for a couple of reasons. Oregon cities, because of who we employ, have unique health care needs. For instance, recently, after the tragedy up in Woodburn, the bombing that took the life of a police captain, a state trooper, critically injured the police chief, the League of Cities, through its insurance arm, City County Insurance Services, discovered that to an officer, the entire police department had opted for an HMO plan that could not meet the mental health needs that were a result of that incident. City County Insurance Services stepped up, and they provided a grant to make sure that took place. But that's if if we're compelled into a pool that's not going to provide us with adequate services, that's going to be a problem for us. Secondly, cities, as a general rule, purchase their health care coverage based on the results of union contracts, labor negotiations and contracts. If the health authority board and the pool in exchange was offering a service that was not going to meet the contracts, the scenario that we could envision happening is one where the city would be in the have to purchase through the pool and then go outside and buy additional coverage. This is going to be added cost for the cities, for city governments, and would result in service cuts to the citizenry. We would look forward to continued conversation on how we would craft this plan. What we would envision, the goal of cities would have, is that we craft a plan that's going to work for all public employers. But we do believe that the options and local governments are going to need the flexibility to purchase the plans that are going to make best sense for them and not be compelled into a one-size-fits-all approach. But we do look forward to continuing this conversation.
Thank you very much. Committee Member Scott and I had a chance this morning to have a discussion on this question of the social mission of health insurance. And if an objective is to reduce the average cost, say, for all cities for their health insurance, and in order to get there, you need to pool everybody, the good risks and the bad risks among that, then the question is, how do you balance that issue? And it's the same problem we're going to have, I think, in discussing the exchange, I think, in the 2011 session, in terms of, can we put together, say, a million lives between all the public purchasers and individual and small group purchasers into a single pool where we could really have an effect on the way healthcare is delivered. We can have an effect on the way it's reimbursed. We can move money to primary care in a way from other kinds of things. But it's going to require, in many cases, a social insurance model that takes, say, a city that has a bunch of young people being willing to go into the plan, even though it might raise their immediate costs, because if all you have is the groups with young people out of the program and the groups with high risks into the program, then all you actually end up doing is increasing the cost for everybody rather than reducing it. But it's this balance, and it's an important balance. Many of us heard it with OWEB in the same discussion with the school districts.
And clearly in OWEB there were losers in that conversation.
Well,
and so I guess I'm Michael.
Short-term losers, you mean? Yeah, in the short term.
I don't see how the League of Oregon Cities can come up and say you support the intent, but yet I don't want to apply.
That's the discussion I think we're going to have when we seriously address what that exchange looks like. Representative Thompson?
No, I think the other thing that we need to build into this somehow, especially as we go public on this, is the difference between insurance as a risk management issue and health care derived therefrom and prepaid medical care. I noticed in talking to constituents about this, anytime you bring up the issue of pre-existing circumstances or more expensive conditions that might require a person to contribute more to it, that's a flare. You know, people are almost preconditioned to wanting a plan that is going to cover whatever they have, whenever they have it, equally with the guy who has no problems. And that's really prepaid health care. Yep. That's not a risk management approach to health insurance.
That's right. And the only way you could even conceivably get to the latter is by having a large enough pool.
Right.
Where individual risks don't change the average very much.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly the kind of dilemma we're going to be facing in this one.
Yeah.
Is health insurance like fire insurance for the rare event that comes up, and to provide indemnity for people who have to pay a lot for a rare event, or is it a way to finance an ongoing system?
Well, the extension of that is then with chronic situations, which is a huge cost driver, what is the responsibility of the patient to participate? You know, if I smoke I'm overweight and I have high blood pressure, do I get the same coverage as the person who doesn't smoke, loses weight, and has high blood pressure?
Actually,
that's more manageable.
That's not the problem. The problem is the skier and the racquetball player.
That too.
It's those adrenaline freaks in our society. People have heard me. You heard me talk about Corvallis the other day. Yeah, we have those people who insist on speeding down the hill to deal with their adrenaline high and raise the price of orthopedics. I think we got to do something about them. They're dangerous. Thank you both very much. Thank you for coming, Liz. Thank you for that story.
That's it.
Nice job. Thank you. Before I close...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have written testimony that we'd like to acknowledge for the record on HB 2435 from Justin Pierce of St. Anthony's Hospital, and he's in support of the bill. And then you also have additional information from Dr. Gerald Swartz on House Bill 2009 for your files.
And you, I distributed to you a bill for proposal for submission as a...
An LC.
An LC for submission as a committee bill. We could handle it now if you want to, or we can do it on...
On Friday.
On Friday.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I have a motion.
Open a work session.
Okay. I'll open a work session for the purpose of getting a committee bill. For introducing a committee bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I move that LC 273 be introduced as a committee bill.
Is there any discussion? All right, would you call the roll, please? Excused.
Louder.
Excused.
Representative
Denbrough?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Kinnamer?
Aye.
Representative Parker?
Aye.
Representative Kotek?
Excused.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Aye. The motion is adopted, and we are adjourned. Thank you for hanging out with us, guys.